SiriusXM Sports presents At the Races with Steve Bick. Horse racing, handicapping, interviews. This is At the Races with Steve Bick.
A very good Friday. Race fans, Sirius 219 XM 201, Sports Zone 964. If you're listening to Sirius XM online and at our website too, stevebick.com. The last Friday of June. Last Friday of the first half of the year. Last Friday before our mid-season vacation break. Always the last, generally the last week of June, first, you know, early July, and the end of the year, December. And I really had no choice. I really have no choice but to take next week if I'm going to get any break at all. That's because Saratoga's move up really kind of, it's kind of in your face, isn't it? Yeah. 2 weeks from yesterday. I mean, it's a little interesting. And actually, it's going to work out okay because the July sale, the 9th and 10th, as well. So it's kind of good that we'll get it in. And granted, you're going to miss the preview of July 4th racing. I get that. But we'll be able to recap it. And also, Iowa, too, thinking about it. The Iowa Derby and Iowa Oaks. I mean, that is the following week, right? Yeah, I think so. And Delaware a little bit, the Oaks, Delaware Oaks, and the Kent. And obviously the big thing is the Stars and Stripes on July 6th, including the first John Nayrud, which I'm delighted about. And the Dwyer and the start of the Turf Trio sequence, the Derby and the Oaks at Belmont, the Rich Belmont Derby and Belmont Oaks. But you'll be all right. You can prepare. There'll be plenty of coverage. Meanwhile, this is a big weekend, and Queen's Plate clearly beyond our conversations about Suffolk. We'll do a second day of Suffolk reminiscence and appreciation. And we've got some fun Boston types that are going to join us, and we'll close out certainly with Lou Raffetto, who has been just amazing, keeping racing really alive in New England single-handedly, not without help, obviously. But, I mean, Lou has been amazing. When it comes to, the resurrections. And ideally, we'll be called on one more time. We'll find out. We'll get some of those answers from Lou later on this morning, hour three. Mike Welch came out of the Boston area, and New England racing was, the start for him. And we'll talk to Mike, and in addition to, his thoughts about Suffolk, we'll also get the chance to discuss Saturday's racing at Gulfstream, which the Summit of Speed as it is, it's not what Bobby Humphrey created. The races are okay. Some interesting, particularly the Smile. I thought some interesting 3-year-olds in there. And we'll get Mike's thoughts. And, of course, there's also the storyline from yesterday. There was speculation that Sunday, a force out of the Rainbow Six. However, things went awry, at least in terms of the planning or the, what was anticipated to be a monster pot for Sunday at Gulfstream. I think people will have to turn their attention instead to the the closing day at Churchill, which is going to have a decent force out pot. But a $3 million, 151,000 payout yesterday in the Rainbow at Gulfstream. And so I mean, how many times has this happened? Actually, a number of times. And you know, you looked at the sequence actually, and it's interesting because you had a $25 winner that was the first leg in the 10 claimer, the maiden claimers, and you had a $54.80 winner in another maiden claimer. This was a more pronounced group of $50,000 maiden claimers. The first one was for a dime. This was $50,000 and a Cantheros as the second longest shot on the board. Sweetheart deal. It wins off and happens to be our Sugar Bear, certainly familiar to New York racing interests, and a Cantheros filly that was bred by Billy Terrell and partner Frank DeSavino. Then a $20 winner, Charette, in a claiming group for Carlos Vacareza, who supposedly is stopping training, but but not yet. This New York bred for $20. So those were the three tough horses. And then you had a even money winner in the nightcap, and you also had, I think, a $5 horse as well. Yeah, $5 winner in the fifth. So three very, you know, mundane types, and then also a $19 winner in the nightcap, and that made somebody $3 million. That was a Safi Joseph trainee that won the nightcap at, actually, Safi was the even money winner in the eighth, but an Artie Schiller for Happy Altar. And actually a horse that that Happy, this was maiden claimer, that Happy bred, too. I turn a night up. So somebody was happy in addition to Happy Altar. Frankly, could have been happy that took down the pot. Who knows? Well, I hadn't seen a note as to where it came from, and maybe Mike has got that. But anyway, the anticipation of what was going to be a, maybe a 10, 12, who knows how many million dollar pot is quashed. So Marty McGee is joining us first to talk about Churchill closing. And you know, I think there's, what, 250, 300,000 probably going into tomorrow on their jackpot. So maybe people will turn their attention in that direction. And, of course, a card with the two-year-olds, highly featured. But the monster jackpot goes away. Plenty of other name brand visitors we'll talk about. Woodbine with Dawn Lupel. Woodbine Dawn. Nick Tamaro certainly will handicap part of the Woodbine races too. Ed DeRosa is up in Toronto, experiencing all the TO has to offer, including apparently a lunch with Tommy Hammer. So there's only a couple of candidacies for where that ends up. Strip joint or jail. if you're gonna hitch your wagon to Tommy Hammer, you're you're in for an experience. Much more too. Don Winfrey is going to join us. A much anticipated Don Winfrey visit to talk about his days at Suffolk and racing in New England. Looking forward to that. Jessica Chappell. Straight out of Boston, she absolutely loves and has chronicled the action at Suffolk and more. And I've got a list of others that we're going to reach out to particularly in the last hour, where it'll be a Suffolk love fest leading into Saturday and Sunday's final 2 days of racing in East Boston. The big story, obviously, out of yesterday And we'll save most of the conversation about it for 9:30 when Matt Hegarty joins us to talk about the Breeders' Cup decision. And if you were on another planet between yesterday afternoon and now, you may not have heard, but the Breeders' Cup made the decision that I think was pretty much the logical one. I know that people are aghast. Some people are aghast, and it seems like it's about a 50-50 split, actually, as to staying at Santa Anita for Breeders' Cup or moving the event. But, you know, as we said the last few days, it seemed like the Breeders' Cup needed to stay, and for a variety of reasons, not the least of which are contractual obligations and the fact that, you know, so many people that anticipate going to Breeders' Cup had made arrangements, reservations and flights and everything else. But, you know, the contractual obligations with the Stronach Group, a big part of this, and the logistic elements. But there's also the matter, frankly, of a show of confidence and support for racing interests in general in California. And moving the event would have really been a devastating message and blow to California racing and its future. And I can tell you just from, you know, from a handful of conversations and input from those kinds of interests, people that live, breed, train, race in California, they wanted and were hoping that this would be the decision. And unanimous, apparently, from the Breeders' Cup board. We'll have Matt talk more about it and what went into it. There's obviously lots of moving parts and questions involved that people are still curious about. And not, you know, not every element of the decision-making process was or is going to be made public, I imagine. But, you know, there were quite a few smoke signals, let's say, and don't care to trade in rumors, but, you know, the legalities, the contractual element, you know, certainly was being, you know, drumbeat, you know, that this had a potential to become, you know, kind of messy from a legal standpoint. Trying to move, you know, because of the wording of contracts. And also, you know, there's no guarantee, frankly, that under the current atmosphere that the industry faces, that, I mean, if pressed into service, obviously, I imagine that Churchill Downs, who was really the only feasible, logically feasible alternative, there's no guarantee that Churchill, under these conditions, necessarily were, you know, eager to take the responsibility on. So there's risks. I know people keep saying, what if? I mean, what if? What if a meteor splits off and strikes Earth? I said the other day, this is a game and an industry that has inherent risk and peril every single day. And I don't know, does that mean you just skulk away and don't face those risks? I think that's part of what is involved here. But it's a show of confidence in California and in Santa Anita. And hopefully by September, when racing returns to Arcadia, the atmosphere around it is not as strained. Let's use that as a word. Marty McGee starts us off. Weekend preview and Suffolk send-off. Queen's Plate weekend as well. Nice field of 14. Feels like the favorites make the most sense. We'll see what Don Lupel thinks and more. Marty McGee after this at the races.
The latest racing news. It's At the Races with Steve Bick on Sirius XM Radio.
With 35 years at the forefront of sports technology, Stats provides next-generation sports content for basketball, baseball, football, soccer. And now, Stats is turning its sights to horse racing. RaceLens is the most in-depth product on the market. With innovative analytics powered by data from Echobase, it will change the way you follow horse racing. Stats RaceLens, bringing clarity to handicapping. Learn more at stats.com/RaceLens.
Learn the business of horses in the world's only accredited equine business program, the University of Louisville Equine Business Program. The University of Louisville has a legacy of excellence for more than 25 years of equine business education. Classes are taught by industry experts in state-of-the-art facilities located in the heartland of America's equine industry. The University of Louisville Equine Business Program. When it comes to horses, we mean business. For more information, visit business.louisville.edu/equine.
Fun in the Sun is Express Vet's summer treasure. If you can't make it to the spa or where the turf meets the surf, do the next best thing and play Saratoga and Del Mar with Express Vet. And while you're at it, don't miss Express Bet's $120,000 Fun in the Sun Handicapping Competition. Play Saturdays by making a live $10 win wager on one horse in each of 10 competition races. Each week, top players collect $5,000 for first, $2,000 for second, $1,000 for third, and $500 for fourth. Plus, based on cumulative earnings throughout the season, the top four finishers will win a Pegasus World Cup Handicapping Championship seat, a $12,000 value each. ExpressBet account holders register free once to play all summer. Don't miss this fantastic opportunity to shoot for some cool, fun-in-the-sun Saturday summer cash with ExpressBet, Saratoga, and Del Mar. Visit ExpressBet.com now to open an account and for complete fun-in-the-sun details.
Account wagering is not permitted in all states. National Problem Gambling Support Line, 1-800-522-4700.
Breaking down the biggest stories in the world of horse racing, this is At the Races with Steve Bick on Sirius XM Radio.
Races coming up on 20 into hour one. Weekend preview and Suffolk send-off as well. Marty McGee is going to send off the Churchill season. It's been a very good one, other than a little hiccup in the Derby. Mart, the scene is ready to shift to Ellis Park. Good morning.
Yeah, other than that, Mrs. Lincoln, how was the play? I love that line. I can't ever enough. It's been simple when it always is. It seems like, you know, with the Derby and all that, all the stuff that goes on with that, and the Oaks, and you know, then the Foster, and it seems like the action never really ends here. We got Ellis starting on Sunday, and I'm sitting here writing about $50,000 maiden races, which, you know, 10 or 15 years ago, when they did that, I think Keeneland was the first one to do it. $50,000 maiden races. Oh, my God. So, yeah, now Ellis is there with them. Of course, other jurisdictions have gone on to have, well, Kentucky, not counting Kentucky Downs, where, you know, you got them 90,000 elsewhere. So, anyway, Ellis Park is keeping a lot of these guys, like the Asmussens and the Cassies and the whoever else, Makers, you know, instead of taking big strings up to Saratoga, they're taking moderate strings, and they're leaving a lot of these horses to run at Ellis.
Well, that's going to be to Ellis's benefit, and of course, there is the changing of hands. And you and I haven't talked about that, but you know, the sale of another sale of Ellis, but the future seems very bright, and we'll deal with Ellis things down the road. A couple of notes, though, that go into this closing Saturday at Churchill, and the two-year-olds in focus on the stakes side, as well as the Kelly's Landing. But you made the great point yesterday, Marty, on Twitter about the biggest jackpot that is going to be available over the weekend because of the surprise hit at Gulfstream that takes the steam out of their proposed Sunday distribution.
Yeah, the ghost of Dan Borislow snuck in on them yesterday. So, yeah, we got about 310 going into today. I would imagine, you know, with everybody recognizing that when you have the force out, they might get, I guess, $1 million, maybe less, on Saturday when they close up here. And it's a good sequence, Steve, with three stakes and a $104,000 turf sprint allowance in the mix. So should be pretty interesting.
It's a terrific card. And even before this situation manifested itself, you know, I had looked at it and, you know, was ready to print out all the stakes. And, you know, then I saw the seventh race allowance, saw that interesting group of $100,000 optional non-winners of three lifetime. It's a very big day tomorrow for the Churchill Downs Racing Club, which sends out both Warriors Club and Distant Shore.
Yeah, I give Distant Shore a big chance off the allowance that he won at Keeneland. And then Warriors Club looks like he's one of the deserving favorites against Petrov, and then the one horse in there, uncontested. That's a good race, the Kelly's Landing.
And you know, just looking at that group in that sixth race, not part of the jackpot sequence, which starts in race seven. But Pyron, nothing wrong with him. And then you got to mention Dumpf, who it seems like Mike Maker will try anything with this horse. He's like a knight on the chessboard. He's jumping all over the place.
Yeah, he's turf, dirt, long, short, up a tin roof, over broken glass, you know, stuff like that.
I love it. I love it. Well, of course, you got the two-year-olds, and let's talk about the Bashford Banner and the debutante, starting to take shape, the two-year-old portion of the season when you get to, you know, the major summer racing.
Well, if you go off Byers, starting with the debutante, which is race 10, post time 5:26 Eastern. I see that Mike Battaglia has made Magic Dance 8-5. If you go off the buyer, Steve, she's like 3-5 in here because nobody's come close to that 84 that she got in that upset of Josie, who came back and won real impressively yesterday at Churchill. So I imagine a lot of bettors are going to be looking at this as a, you know, the bingo free space with Magic Dance, the Three Chimneys Homebred. She was 8-1. I think she was the second choice of the Asmussen horses in that race that she won on June the 7th. But, boy, she did it the right way. And Steve, you know, a lot of times Steve and some of the bigger trainers will run two or three in a spot like this, but I guess he felt like he only needed one, and that's Magic Dance.
We should point out the presence of a well-known West Coast two-year-old operation in Mike Harrington, and Cholula Lips, the Empire Way, a Calbred, shows up out here, puts the blinkers on, and I would not be dismissive. Harrington, you know, famous for his work with juveniles, and, you know, this horse won quite easily First Asking State Bred, I haven't looked at the what's the morning line on here, Mart? What do we got price?
Yeah, they got her second choice at 7-2. You know, she was 21-1 when she won at First Asking at Santa Anita against Cowbred.
Yeah.
And she does get Bayerano. I can't remember the last time he rode her. I guess maybe one of the Derby or Breeders' Cup times. But, as we all know, back in 03, 04, 05, 06, Bayerano, he was the man around here till the kind of the new regime, the LeParoux and Lannery started taking over. And of course, Raffaele's had a terrific career out there. But I'm sure he's got a lot of friends still here in Kentucky.
Oh, there's no doubt, and I'm just curious, actually, because looking at the rest of the card, what else does he did he pick up any other? Yeah, he did. He's got some mounts today.
Yeah, I think he was named on two today. One of them was an AE, and I don't know if he'll come in or not. I mean, they're running at Los Al, so I guess you know this is the time of year when a lot of these cow jocks show up elsewhere. But, he rides for Jorge Peraban in the Bachelor Manor. He rides the morning line favorite and Phantom Boss. I don't know if that horse will come as strongly as 9-5 on there, but because it's a much more well-matched race than its Philly counterpart, the debutante.
Well, and he also has got Vicky Oliver in that pretty heady turf sprint, that ninth race. I was going to ask you about the ninth as well. Bill Mott's using him on Haunt in that seventh I mentioned. And he's also got Mott in a maiden race going in the third. Vicky Oliver's got him in the fifth in a maiden claimer, too. So Rafi had no trouble getting calls.
Absolutely not. Yeah, I like Smart Remark. He ran a big second behind World of Trouble two back on Derby Eve and kind of ruined my supers, even though I'd been a fan of this horse. But anyway, that's a way wide open race, the ninth race. And again, it's part of the single six sequence. I've got Will Call tabs in there for Richard Klein and Cox. I think he's better than he's shown his last few.
Well, we also got Anguston, who's kind of a house horse on the show. We love us some Anguston.
You do. I was going to wait. I was really waiting for when you were going to bring him up.
I love it. Let's talk about the Bashford and the Grade 3. What do we know here?
I've got a maiden pick in there. Number 8, Verb for Calumet and Keith DeSormo. He ran a winning race last time out, just gave it up late, going the 5.5. And, you know, with those couple of races behind him, I think he's as good as any in here. You know, again, Phantom Boss in from California for Parabon is 9-5 on the line. I don't know. If he's away a split second behind the rest of the others, he's going to be in a world of trouble. So, you know how I favor the outside horses in these one-turn races. So I'm going to go with Bourbon here in a mild upset.
There you go, the little the Marty McGee open air outside box. Where?
Where the air is fresh and clear, and I actually stole it from Toby Collette.
Yeah. Snell, for John and Enos as well. Two sloppy track efforts, but that last one behind Half Moon Reef earned a nice fig. You mentioned Phantom Boss and. What else is going on in here? Pat Byrne has got one for the Sandifords.
Yeah, Alec and Arthur, they only ran one allowance at this meet, and they needed some fillies. Actually, it was more fillies than colts. And Alec and Arthur won easily, and John Hancock promised me that the horse is going to run big, and that Tyler Gaffalione told him he would win, so there you go.
Well, and John Hancock, a very dangerous horseman with young horses, and this for the Wesley Ward Factory, Hat Creek, and interesting group. Rowdy Yates, Rawhide on the outside, the morning line, and this is an eclectic group, kind of fun. The Grade 3 Bashford Manor, and then if you're live all the way to the end in the jackpot, you got a mile maiden group that looks really competitive.
Yeah, inscrutable. I picked my brother in there, big beautiful Wally, ran a couple big races with over Keeneland. He was in the belly, as Toby Collette would say, at 47-1. Kind of blew up a lot of the exotics. I did have the try that day, and it ran good in his next time out with newfound show of speed. But you know, this is a tough one too. I mean, there's six or eight of them who could logically win the finale, the meet finale, not just the Saturday finale, the meet finale, Vic.
Well, I do have news. Our friend Dan Hart, who's part of the Churchill Downs Racing Club, he says that Warner's Club is going to scratch. They're going to go to Saratoga with him.
Which one?
Warriors Club.
Wow. Yeah, you know, yeah. I'd asked Gary Palmisano, who runs the group, and he had said either that, this or that. So I just assumed when they entered, they would go ahead and run, because he looks like he's in a good spot. But I guess, you know, this horse has knocked out, what, close to $800,000. That he was the first one they had too. That's good
crazy.
Work.
It really is
good. So yeah,
one of those crazy stories.
Yeah,
I got to mention. You had enough. I was going to mention Control Stake in there too. Although Greg Foley's cross entered. Do you know what he's doing?
I do not. I know that there's some other cross entry on this card. If you brought it up, I could tell you, but. I really like Uncontested in there.
All right.
Going to Amos. You know, he's working well for Amos here. And you look back on his page, hell, he won the General George earlier this year. He's a nice horse. So I'm going with him in there.
Well, and Marty, I appreciate it. And we'll talk Ellis when we get together next. We're off next week. And as we go, we're waiting for Matt Hegarty, who's going to give us the report on the Breeders' Cup decision. I guess some of the hotels are going to have some cancellations to deal with.
Well, Tim Sullivan and the Courier kept writing about how the Omni, like they had jacked up their rate to, you know, Derby levels. And that was the main clue that he was going on, that it was a foregone conclusion they were going to come here to Churchill. And with a couple people in the know, they said, not so fast. And I commend the decision. I really think it was the right call. And, you know, I'll be glad to go out to Santa Anita this fall.
Absolutely. Marty McGee, everybody. DRF McGee. Marty, have a great 4th. We'll talk to you in a few weeks.
All right, buddy. Thanks a lot.
Marty McGee and his colleague, Matt Hegarty, standing by. And I was just kidding Marty a little bit, Matt, about the flurry of hotel room cancellations in Louisville. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me on.
I appreciate the visit, and obviously everybody knew that the Breeders' Cup Executive Board was going to meet on this Thursday, and they were waiting for the end of the Santa. Not that they were, you know, that they made a special schedule meeting, but that meeting was going to be important for determination about staying at Santa Anita. Talk about what transpired, Matt.
Yeah, I think the Breeders' Cup, you know, obviously this was a regularly scheduled board meeting, but the topic of discussion was certainly going to be what would be probably the last opportunity for them to even consider a move of the event from Santa Anita this year, which is obviously scheduled for early November. So, you know, coming out of the meeting, we did get you know, the type of language that would indicate that the Breeders' Cup board was united behind this decision to stay at Santa Anita. And I think they faced a very tough decision. You know, the criticism that that racing has been forced to take over the last 4 months is not just isolated at Santa Anita. In a lot of cases, it's looking at the sport itself. So I don't think that just moving the event would have let the racing industry escape, you know, the spotlight that has been trained on it. So I think this was a very tough decision. There would have been some pretty heavy logistical problems as far as moving the event. Like I said, I don't think there was a good, you know, there was a good way out of this. There is no out. You know, you got it. You either have to stick with your planning, or you have to, you know, disrupt a lot of the logistical problems for what might not have been a payoff anyway.
Well, and you know, for those that are that, for the most part, I think the opinion is pretty split on this, as to, you know, the dangers, the risks of going forward at Santa Anita or moving. And you know, it seems to me, Matt, that taking away the autumn meet at Santa Anita, that we'll address that separately, but. You know, for those that say, well, what if there is a incident, you know, on a national television? Well, if there's an incident, it doesn't matter if the incident's at Santa Anita. I suppose it's maybe hyper aware at Santa Anita. But if it was at Churchill, you know, there's plenty of people that kept citing, you know, the Courier Journal's twisted reporting on you know, Churchill's surface, going back to the spring, and you know, saying if there's a problem there, how is it any, you know, how is it any better than a problem at Santa Anita?
Yeah, I think that there's some validity to that opinion, although I will say that that horse racing in California, as much as it is a part of the national industry, would suffer a really a really tough blow if there is an incident on Breeders' Cup Day at Santa Anita. I think you will have a lot of people who have very powerful constituencies, who have very strong voices that might actually it could lead to some serious ramifications for California. That would have, you know, ripple effects in the racing industry at large. Maybe you escape that, you know, for California if you go to another track and there is an incident. But at the same time, you know, we have to remember that the Breeders' Cup is a pretty safe event if you go back through the event's history. Obviously, there were some, you know, there have been some incidents that that obviously, you know, drew attention. But like I said, it's hard for me to say that there was a good or less bad way to go forward. This is a tough time for the industry. And at some point the industry has to say, which I think was illustrated by, you know, the panoply of statements that were issued by various organizations, including other racetracks, that says, look, we are really trying. You know, you look at what the CHRB has done, you look at what Santa Anita has done. You know, there hasn't been a track that has implemented so many new protocols than Santa Anita over the past 4 months. Whether or not those are actually effective, we don't know yet. We don't have enough data. But they are putting in place the type of protocols that people recommend to be in place. And so the industry does have to at some point say, this is what we are doing. We are doing our best. And unfortunately, all of us in racing know that when you're dealing with horses, the best is not enough. You know, horses are fragile animals. These things will happen in racing no matter what you do. Those things would happen with a horse that is running across a field or a wild Mustang roaming the American Southwest. So it's just a very difficult spot for the racing industry to be in, but at some point it's got to start moving forward.
You mentioned, and you kind of alluded to the situation from a pressure standpoint and the political arm in California, and a lot was made as part of this announcement about this week or the last, you know, 10 days, the mechanics that Governor Newsom, you know, urged for the CHRB to have, you know, not having to deal with that 10-day period that they can now, you know, CHRB would have the authority to, you know, shut down any license on their authority, essentially. And that was addressed yesterday, I know, by Craig Fravel, who, and this is the portion I was referencing in terms of the September and into October autumn meet at Santa Anita. And, you know, people rightly have said, well, what happens if there's issues, you know, during the September-October lead up? And, you know, that's the sword of Damocles that hangs here.
Yeah, that's where I think this is most problematic for Santa Anita. The CHRB is in no way the most political powerful force in California. They now do have the power to unilaterally shut down racing at a racetrack. If they are faced with a political backlash to shut down racing at Santa Anita, then I don't think they can resist a powerful enough wave. So this, I think, is the most problematic part of Santa Anita. Now, you know, the CHRB has also been part of implementing these new protocols, and they have a reputation to defend as well. So it gets a little difficult to handicap what exactly, you know, would happen should there be more criticism leveled at Santa Anita in the run-up to the Breeders' Cup. But at the same time, the CHRB itself released a statement following the Breeders' Cup announcement saying that they applauded them for staying at Santa Anita, that the new measures they've put in place, you know, that they hope that will lead to less frequency of catastrophic breakdowns. So you would think, you know, and this is probably some speculation, but I'm assuming – and I do know that the Breeders' Cup officials met with the CHRB officials over the last couple of weeks. And if you saw, there was a quote in my article in which Craig Vrabel, the CEO of Breeders' Cup, said, "We don't think it will be a knee-jerk reaction should there be more criticism standing in need of the air there." That they probably have discussed this and said, "Look, you know, we're going to stick to our guns to the measures that we've implemented, and." You know, only in a dire circumstance would that order come. Like I said, they are not the most powerful agency in California by any means. So that remains the biggest danger, in my opinion.
Matt Hegarty with us and working off his report from yesterday in the wake of the Breeders' Cup, reaffirming their site for the fall at Santa Anita. Two questions, Matt, before we wrap up. And one, a undetailed backup plan should something transpire. Vrabel said there is a contingency plan that they've got in reserve. And then the Jerry Hollendorfer issue. And Vrabel hinted but didn't specifically answer. But what are your thoughts on those two elements?
As far as the backup plan, I would hesitate to speculate on that, with the exception that there's only one track out there that is racing at the same time as Breeders' Cup will be held, that can merely open the gates and allow a Breeders' Cup crowd in the door. Unfortunately, that track is 2,500 miles away. It's Churchill Downs in Louisville. If there is a stop order that is issued, say, 2 weeks before the event, can you logistically make that happen? It's hard to tell. Now, can you van everyone down to Del Mar? Possibly, but you're probably not dealing with the criticism. It's a California-centric criticism. So I don't know what the backup plan is. I hope that it doesn't have to be triggered, but it does seem like there are very limited options for what Breeders' Cup could do.
Jerry Hollendorfer and Craig Vrabel seem to say that they're not going to make any judgments right now, but that he was hinting at being able, given the Breeders' Cup control of a venue typically during the Cup, he was sort of hinting at the fact that Hollendorfer, should he have Breeders' Cup runners, he seemed to be hinting that that they'll make arrangements. What was your take on that?
Yeah, I have no idea how they're going to deal with Hollendorfer. Breeders' Cup has its own rules of entry. You know, one of those is that any trainer who has a you know, Class 1 positive over the past year would be denied the entry box. In this case, Hollendorfer, you know, has not violated that provision. He's been banned by a track order. That track order was issued by the Sternick Group applying to its California tracks. So I think, you know, we still have 5 months to go until the event. We don't know how those situations would change. And, you know, I would recommend that that people who are interested in the Hollendorfer case read Jay Hubday's column that was posted yesterday on our site.
I'm glad you cited it, because I was going to as well. And Matt, as always, the hard news keeps us busy. This, you know, this is a kind of an amorphic story that, kind of shapeless. You know, things like the medication policy issue and the five-person veterinary staff. You know, those things that, you know, are involved here. We, you know, some uncertainties, but it'll play out as it does. But it does feel that this was an important affirmation for racing in California and for Santa Anita. And the alternative, to me, seems like it would have been devastating to California racing prospects.
Yeah, that is another situation we didn't touch on that would have just been kind of the fallout from this idea that Breeders' Cup was going to abandon it. So that's, you know, more of a philosophical discussion than anything, but that would have certainly been an impact out there.
Matt Hegarty, who does a tremendous job doing the hard news for the DRF. Matt, I appreciate it. DRF Hegarty, have a great 4th of July, and we'll see you in Saratoga, right? When you usually up for a couple of weeks?
Yeah, I'll be up there for starting with the Saratoga sales on August 5th, and then not sure if I'll be staying through Traverse Week, but we'll definitely be up there for a couple of weeks. So.
Outstanding. We will see you then, and usually Matt, also you stay for the roundtable, right? You got the Jockey Club roundtable to cover.
Yes, yeah.
Always a thrilling afternoon.
Yeah, I love putting on a tie in summer heat at 10 o'clock on a Sunday morning.
Matt always also gives us a visit with Seth Merrow with Loose on the Lead. We always hold a spot for Matt during the summer. Matt, thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
Matt Hegarty. We're going to stay right here because there's just too much. There's just too much to cover. And that includes Queen's Plate Day, one of North America's just great afternoons at a racetrack anywhere. And the plate takes center stage tomorrow. Big field of 14. Tremendous card start to finish, and actually even into Sunday with the Dominion Day. There's also a stake warm-up today. Dawn Lupel joins us. Woodbine Dawn, good morning.
Good morning, Steve. How are you?
Excellent. And I'm heading to Suffolk for their last 2 days ever. So I was seriously considering a Woodbine run. I have not seen a plate, and this would have been a good one to see.
Oh, for sure. Yes, it's fairly wide open, although I think there will be one or two distinctive favorites. But yes, it's always a great show. You'll come. I know you'll get here.
I promise I will. And let's dive into it. And we'll go from the plate and we'll work our way backward through this terrific card. And we'll mention that the 8th, 9th, and 10th are part of the cross-country pick 5 with Naira using the Mother Goose and the 8th and the 9th, the Mother Goose and a starter allowance at Belmont. And the Dance Smartly, the Highlander, and the Queen's Plate are the other three races. And the plate, hard not to start with the rail horse. Neil Howard joined us after the win in the Woodbine Oaks, and there's been such a great history of fillies in the plate, and let's start there.
Oh, for sure. And her name is Desert Ride, daughter of Tandy Ride. Very lightly raced, just the 4 starts, 3 of them being wins. She looks like the real deal. Started her career on turf, the one trip up to Woodbine for the synthetic race in the Oaks, and she was extremely impressive. Let go at a very plump 8-1 on that day. I'm still kicking myself. Trust me, I am. And she didn't, it's not like she had an easy trip at all, and she kind of hit the gate, and then she was really wide. She was languishing at the back of a field of 10, and then just kind of got grinding down the stretch, and man, she was flying. Steve Bann rode her so perfectly, and he's back for the ride in the plate.
Got to mention, because, you know, for those that wonder about the prospects of Desert Ride, there's some things going on with her that people should be aware of. And I would imagine, Dawn, I mean, in Canada, everyone, you know, people that follow the game need no introduction to Samson. This filly happens to be out of the sister of Desert Isle, who runs earlier on the card, as it happens, in the Zadrakarta. Desert Isle, out of Eye of the Sphinx, and, of course, the dam of Eye of the Leopard, won the plate in 09, the dam of Hotep, who was second in the plate, in 10. I mean, there is a lot going on in here. This is the family of Quiet Resolve, Quiet Cleo, Queen of Egypt. This is one of the great Canadian families of Samson or any other operation.
It's the beautiful red and gold colors of the Samson farms. They have been so prolific in breeding excellent horses. Their bloodlines trace back to the best of the best, and you just mentioned a few, Steve. It's amazing, and the story is kind of a little bit sad, but so overwhelming. I spoke with Samson Farms, of course, Ernie Samuel, one of the founders, and it continues on through the children, and young Michael Belaz, whose mother Tammy, of course, was a Samuel. She passed from cancer a few years ago, but he loves the game. He's a young, very energetic, enthusiastic member of the Samson team, and it's great to have the youth coming through that organization. He told me right after the race, and I have to say he had a little tear in his eye because, yes, the Grand Dam of Desert Ride, I guess they just lost her this year as well. So it was very, very heartbreaking to see her go. The Desert Ride, obviously, with that great run in the Woodbine Oaks, looks to continue a legacy that, it's inexplicable the quality of horses that they produce at the Samson Farm.
Well, one of the stallions, one of the Canadian sires that we talk about was Sid Fernando on Sire Watch Pedigree Focus, presented by Hill and Dale, is Vice Regent, and Vice Regent figures very prominently in this family. You mentioned Tammy, and I think back to a conversation, she was on the show, and really one of the great, really attracting 45, maybe.
So young, yeah.
Not fair. Steve Bahan, part of this story, too, and got to be excited for him to have a plate shot.
Oh, absolutely. And the Woodbine Oaks he won, that was the third Woodbine Oaks. He has won the Queen's plate before. It was with a huge long shot, TJ Last Moon, I think. I'm probably getting the name wrong because my memory is, you know, a little bit sieve-like these days. But it was one of the TJ's Lucky Moon, that's what it was. It was a huge long shot. So he will look for another victory here. I thought she drew really well. I don't mind her down on the inside. It's not a spot that anybody would choose if they given their choice of 14. But I don't think it's bad for her because I think she can sit just kind of mid-pack and hopefully get some clear sailing.
The pace setter, I got to figure that one Bad Boy, who's a horse that our listeners, Dawn, are very familiar with because Baltus absolutely gave a huge push to when I asked him about one Bad Boy's maiden breaker. He could not have been more effusive in praise. And I got, even with the blinkers coming off, I got the sense that Flavian Pratt is going to be the one to catch in here.
I would think so. I'll be curious to see what Jamie Spencer does with the 7 Federal Law, because since coming up here to Woodbine this season, he's been a little bit stiff in the face, let's say, early on in his races. In the plate trial, Gary Boulanger just, he let him roll a little bit, and it was a good strategy. He did get beat, but it was only by one horse. Pay for Peace went by him. So I'll be curious to see if Spencer is able to keep Federal Law away from a horse like one Bad Boy, maybe just sit outside of him, because other than those two, I'm not thinking that anybody's going to want to go too quickly early. So if they can do that, it could be a little bit of a tactical race and trying to get some slow fractions early on.
One of the other favorites, and like you were hinting, it does feel that even with the bulky field that there's two, three horses that have an edge, and obviously Desert Ride is one of them. The other one is Skywire that, again, our listeners heard early on from Mark Cassie, even going back to the beginning of the winter, that Skywire was going to be one of his plate horses, Gary Barber and Lou Tucci. And give us some thoughts about Skywire, who doesn't have a gaudy record, but seems poised coming into this.
He's my pick. He is, yeah, for sure. I'm going to take him on top because I think strategically, I think he'll have the pick of the litter here in terms of trip. It's Mark Cassie sending out both Federal Law and Skywire. Cassie's had, you might have heard of him this year. He's had an okay season so far. Just taking two out of three legs of the Triple Crown in the States with two different horses. He wants to win this race again. He's won it with two fillies, with Lexi Lou, and of course last year with Wonder Godot, Lexi Lou in 2014, who was, you know, and Gary Barber's won this race with those fillies. So Skywire going to be my pick. Big work. June the 23rd, 47, I was able to see it just on tape. I thought he looked tremendous. Eureka Da Silva, our leading rider, had been riding Avi's Flatter as well as a juvenile, and now here he appears on Skywire. And I talked to him a little bit, and he said he's really, really a nice horse. So modest purchase of $45,000. This horse looks like the real deal.
Josie Carroll with a pair. He's a macho man, and you look all the way outside to Avi's Flatter for Tall Oaks, her regular and big client, Ivan Delos. Mm-hmm. There's also a horse we got to mention that if you want to do some key race watching, you look to Tone Broke, the Asmussen Broken Vow, that is coming out of the Sir Barton, and of course King for a Day. Won the Sir Barton and then spun into that Pegasus and turned in one of the best three-year-old performances of the year, beating Maximum Security. And Tone Broke, kind of an interesting party in here, making a synthetic debut.
We want to talk about kind of humble beginnings and then the trip over to Dubai, obviously not really very productive in any way, shape, or form. But I think you have to look at him as a contender. I thought he relaxed beautifully in the Sir Barton. I thought it was a productive run. We'll see. I mean, Steve Asmussen used to run the string out of Woodbine a few years ago, so he's definitely familiar with the surroundings and what kind of horse you need to bring here. I like the entrance of this horse. I think he adds another dimension and one that you have to consider for sure in your verticals.
Well, and Broken Vow, nothing wrong with Broken Vow as a sire of horses on the synthetic and out of a Smart Strike mare. There's plenty of reason to think that Tone Broke handles the footing, and stylistically, he could sit behind whatever speed materializes.
Yeah, absolutely. It looks like he has that. I mean, he has a little bit of tactical speed if needed. If, you know, Contreras decides he wants to get a little bit closer. But he relaxes beautifully. I think that's one of his biggest strengths. He's that kind of horse that I think is very kind to the rider and will sit wherever you put him.
Well, those are among the major obvious candidates. Any prices, Dawn, in here that you think need to be feathered into ticket building?
You know, I wish he had a little bit more experience, but I think the 8, he's a macho man, the other Josie Carroll horse. Mm-hmm. I think this is a really nice horse in the making. He's only run 3 times. This is a little bit, I mean, it's a lot to ask of a horse that's that lightly raced, but we talk about Philly, too. She's only run 4 times. But just the way this horse is developing, he's got a beautiful run-on style. The distance will absolutely be no problem whatsoever. He is 2 for 2 here on the synthetic, and it looks like he has been working extremely well, too. So if I was looking for a price horse, he would be the one.
15-1 with Patrick Husbands. And Patrick last saw the Queen's Plate winner's circle with Lexi Lou, the aforementioned Gary Barber and Mark Cassie. Let's get through a few other of the highlights on the day. And right before the plate, the Grade 1 Sprint, the Highlander, and kind of an interesting group this year. A lot of times it's been familiar turf sprint faces. There's a few kind of new players that showed up for this.
There are, yes. Tom Proctor's horse, Caribou Club, he's 7-5 on the morning line. Van Dyke's going to be here. He's riding. See, we actually rode the horse before way back in 2017 in Del Mar. It was a beautiful off-the-pace win. To me, the 7-5 morning line is legit. I think the race flows through him. If he doesn't take to the course for some reason, who knows, then I would think the one Extravagant Kid with up here for Brendan Walsh with Rafael Hernandez riding would be kind of an interesting alternative. But, yeah, Caribou Club, I just really can't get past him.
And of course, Proctor and Craig Burnick, Glen Hill Farm. And I do have to mention the only horse in this field, Don, that's won at the distance. White Flag, who's 3-6, going 6 on the turf.
Yeah, he's the interesting one. Now, he's wearing bar shoes, so and I don't love horses with bar shoes, I have to be honest, but they're there for a reason. It's better if they need them, it's better that they're there. But I agree, in terms of distance, he's probably the most natural 6-furlong horse. Caribou Club is maybe a little bit more of a natural miler. He was impressive when he won the Connaught Cup here at 7 furlongs. So that would be the only thing, is just making sure that he's in the race and not having too much work to do. We've had very warm weather lately, Steve, and sometimes when it's warm and humid like this, the course can get, we had so much rain this year, I mean, like most of the Eastern Seaboard, but the last few days have been quite dry. So the turf can kind of start to lean towards being speed favoring as it dries out. So, you know, as a real closing kind of type, you want to not get too far back. It can be a big detriment.
Well, one horse that's going to be mid-pack kind of stalking and going, if you're looking for a price in here, how about my guy Trombetta with my man Bo Lane having bred Wet Your Whistle? And this is a horse that has really, really emerged. And on a 3-race win streak, 10-1, awfully nice. And that last race performance at Monmouth absolutely stands with anything that anybody in here has run of late. Wet Your Whistle at 10-1 has got to be on tickets. Let's talk about the Dance Smartly, and one of the all-time greats, the Triple Crown winner, and you happen to have a plate winner in this field. Jimmy Jerkins brings Holy Helena back, but now she's a turf horse, Dawn.
She is, and she's doing so well. I am such a fan of her. I always wondered if distance races were going to be her thing. If you look at her, she looks more like, you know, a mile's kind of pushing it. No, I mean, she'll run 16 miles by the looks of it. She's got so much heart, and it's great to see her back here. She's run on this turf course just once in the Dance Smartly last year. She kind of got going a little bit too late and finished a solid closing third as the favorite. I don't think that she'll be in that position again. I think Castellano is going to be very cognizant of the fact that you just can't get too far back. Even at the mile and a quarter, you just can't leave yourself too much work to do.
Well, she's got one thing going for her, and that is that there's no Chad Brown horses in here as opposed to last year. That makes it a little bit easier for everybody. Holy Helena from the rail, and she's 9-5 favorite. Just kind of thumbing through the rest of this group. Barbara Minchel, one of our favorites, Get Explicit. Starship Jubilee, Kevin Hannard. Nothing wrong with those two.
No, Starship Jubilee has, she's got the nose to win. She's 12-27. She's won here. She's won at Gulfstream. She was a runner-up in the Nassau on a yielding course last year. I think that was a beautiful prep, although do you use grade twos to prep for grade twos? Why not? Sometimes you have to. But I think it was beautiful the way she ran. She actually had the lead and got caught late. I'm okay with that because the course was very tiring on that day. She's working well, and I'm going to take her. I will take her on top of Holy Helena in the Dance Smartly.
There's a maiden group of two-year-olds that breaks things up a little bit between the stakes and then that stake sequence, the Dance Smartly, the Highlander, and the Plate. Look like there's some nice horses in there. In fact, pretty much everybody represented. Cassie, there's Barbara Minchel, and Ralph Biamonte, and Nick Gonzalez, everybody. But let's talk before we break about the King Eddie and the King Edward, the other graded stake on the card.
Yes, race number 6, flat mile on the turf. I love this race. It's one of my favorites. It looks like Mike Stidham has sent up a bit of a barn burner here with a horse named Synchrony. We haven't seen him run here at Woodbine, but it looks like he has the right kind of style. And actually, his last race, the Monmouth, I was very impressed with how McCarthy was able to get this horse to sit just off of the pace. He hadn't been doing that. He'd been coming from much further back. I think having that versatility and the ability to be close early on can definitely help, especially if we are getting any kind of a speed-favoring bias whatsoever. And this horse, just, he kind of goes out there and he does his thing, right? And he was 4-for-8 last year. He wins his races along the way. It's unfortunate to Bob last time out where he didn't quite get up in time. But I think he's well meant. And again, 7-to-5 morning line, and he looks like a short-priced horse who could be the one.
Don Lupel, plate day. I ask you one question every year. What are we going to see you wearing? You got to give us the preview.
Oh, man. I tell you, it's whatever it is, it has to be cool because temperatures have been a little bit steamy here the last few days and comfortable because there's a lot of walking on plate day. So it will be a combination of cool, comfortable, and hopefully fashionable. I got to dig through the closet and see what's in there.
You usually in the morning when you send out the plate day greetings, you give everybody the preview, and we'll preview also Sunday, and of course Canada Day coming up on Monday, but the Dominion Day, the Grade 3 on Sunday, with quite a few familiar players, including Atfield with Are You Kidding Me, our friends the Owellings, Pumpkin Rumble, who's really been tremendous, over $500,000 now in earnings, and ahead by a century. Heartfelt tribute, and Super Tappet, who righted the ship in the Eclipse for Mrs. Weber and Mark last time.
Yeah, it's a great race, you know, because we're all going to be like so spry come Sunday after the marathon that is Queen's Plate Day. But yeah, we've got two stakes. The Dominion Day goes as race number 8, and all those players that you just mentioned are. There's a lot of intrigue in there. It's just a field of 6, but there are some different horses that I'm. You know, Super Tappa is such a nice win in the Eclipse. It was just really solid. Final Copy won an allowance very easily coming into this race. Special Forces is rolling off a couple wins. Pumpkin Rumble, I think Pumpkin Rumble is the one. To me, he just with the resume he's bringing into it and the form that he is riding right now, I think he'll be the guy.
Well, it could be a big day then for the Old Wellings because they've got one in the Bison City too, and I think a maiden running on Sunday.
I know
they got 3 in, yeah, Bill and Al.
Yeah, like they're such great people. They do a lot on social media. They're just they're wonderful fans of the game and very enthusiastic and just the kind of owners that you love to have. Yeah, the Bison City's come up tough enough. Bold Script finished a neck back of Desert Ride, who we talked about, who's in the plate. Bold Script choosing to stick with the fillies and go in the $225,000 Bison City, so she'll be featured prominently. Rosina for Kieran McLaughlin coming here off of a second place finish on a sloppy track. That's one of the maidens. So yeah, there's some different horses in here that'll be interesting. And Tanga Rose has been a little disappointing to me lately. I thought she was going to be a little bit better, but she could regroup.
Don Lupel, everybody, Woodbine Don, and looking forward to Plate Day tomorrow. I appreciate this as always, Don. Best of luck to everybody in TO, and we'll talk soon.
Thanks, Steve. We're looking forward to the weekend, and you have a great one yourself. I have to come to that beautiful part of the country up by Suffolk, and it appeals to me for some reason. I'm a big Stephen King fan, and he writes about all that kind of stuff. So, yeah.
Scarborough Downs. You can go for the harness at Scarborough if you want to go to Maine. But Saratoga, have you been to Saratoga?
I've never been, no, and yet I feel like I know the place because I watch it so enthusiastically every year. And listen, I live vicariously through all others, but I'm always up here at Woodbine during that meet.
Well, you could maybe sneak in. You should sneak in.
Maybe
for
a Monday.
Wednesday.
Maybe
yeah,
Monday.
Well, we're not running Monday anymore. This year, the first year of the 5 day a week, but maybe a Wednesday? Can you sneak in for a Wednesday, maybe?
It's possible. Just don't tell anyone.
Have you know what? Tommy, Tommy Hammer. Have Hammer bring you down.
There you go.
I love it. Don Lupel, thanks so much.
Thanks, Steve.
plate day tomorrow, and we'll talk to Ed DeRosa later. Eddie up there for, I think, like maybe the second or third time, maybe in a row. He's turned into a plate, a regular plate goer. We were looking for Nick. We'll take a break instead. We've done an hour already. We're going to start bringing in Suffolk guests as well. Back after this at the races.
The latest racing news. It's at the races with Steve Vick on Sirius XM Radio.
DRF Sportsform Digital Edition, your ultimate weekly betting guide. Published by Daily Racing Form, DRF Sportsform delivers all of the analysis and insight you need for every NFL game and more than 40 college football matchups. Beat the spread with powerful trends and sharp angles. Tap into best bets, expert picks, parlay winners, and more. All for just $4.99 per issue. Get this week's edition free. Visit drf.com/sportsform. Enter code DRF Sports.
University of Arizona Racetrack Industry Program can prepare you for an exciting career in racing. Turn your passion into a paycheck. Nearly 90% of our students are employed in the racing industry immediately upon graduation. What career track are you on? The University of Arizona Racetrack Industry Program. Enroll today and get on track for success. For scholarship opportunities and more, check out our website at ua-rtip.org.
Do you ever wonder what happens to your old friends, including the great champions that inspired unforgettable memories, and maybe even let you cash a ticket or two over the years? We even have a former child prodigy.
Here is a superstar. That horse's name is Afternoon Delights, and kept the summer on Afternoon Delights absolutely galloping in the Hollywood Futurities.
These are the champions that help out the horses that might not have won a Grade 1 race, but always tried just as hard. Come visit them all at Old Friends when you're in Kentucky or at our Bobby Frankel division, Old Friends in Saratoga. I know they'll be glad to see you. Go to oldfriendsequine.org or call us at 502-863-1775.
Get started in Kentucky. Over $8 million in additional purse money is available at the five Kentucky tracks for horses eligible for the Kentucky Thoroughbred Development Fund. Kentucky is a good place to race your Kentucky bred. Come home to Kentucky and make a start.
HorseBills.com is a cost-effective, time-saving, paperless revolution. Vendors are able to generate electronic invoices for owners and other vendors who can pay through HorseBills.com for just 50 cents. Turn hours of work into minutes with our easy-to-use site. Have our team take over your bookkeeping or continue to do it yourself and pay only our low monthly subscription fee. Check out our video tutorial on the HorseBills.com YouTube channel and get started today for free. HorseBills.com. Toll-free number 888-9000. 938-4643.
Now, back to At the Races with Steve Vick on Sirius XM Radio.
We're back at the races. You can take it from me that Lou Raffetto has kept racing in the Boston area alive repeatedly. You heard the references to Lou yesterday and our parade of Suffolk tributes and Suffolk visits continue. And we wanted it to start this morning with a visit from Lou himself. Lou, emotional time for so many people. The New England racing fraternity and graduates scattered to the winds, obviously, but everybody with their hearts in East Boston going into the weekend.
Well, this is true. You know, and so much was said, and so many wonderful things were said yesterday, and, you know, they're all true. And the number of people, one of the things that hit me yesterday was the number of outstanding trainers, horsemen in general, jockeys, have come from this area over the years. And as you say, scattered now. And there's a true love for the sport here. It's a shame that we're in this position for the reasons that we are. But I have to say that, you know, it's obviously bittersweet. It's going to be a great weekend, and I'm glad you're coming up to join us. But it's been a good run for the last 5 years. We've been able to keep things going for a lot of people. It's been very financially beneficial. And everybody here at the track, at every level, has benefited from the program. It's just a shame it has to end right now.
We'll talk about what might transpire long term for racing interests and the opportunity for racing in New England, but a couple of retrospective thoughts and backdrop from you, Lou. I mean, talk about your own personal ties and how you came to originally to Suffolk and of course the various times along the way that it took monumental efforts to keep things going.
Well, I think back, of course, it was in 1991 when I was offered the position, and I had decided not to take it. And then I met with Jim Mosley. Ironically, we have the final state race in his name today. After I met with Jim, he was just a wonderful person. I decided to take the job. And I still remember Ed Gray interviewing me, and I was looking at the grandstand at that point. It was surrounded, the building and the grounds were surrounded with barbed wire. And I just left Mom and Park. And I said to him, I said, have I lost my mind coming here, leaving the place like mine? Subsequently, I was able to put together wonderful people, very proud of the people that have passed through here. You know, people like Barry Colmes and Chip Tuttle, T.D. Thornton. I mean, we've had just to name a couple, and we've had a great team of people that have made this all happen. And obviously the most fortuitous thing that happened along the way was Cigar in 95. I mean, the whole situation when I created that bonus was to try to get Holy Bull, and, didn't know who Cigar was in January of 95. And obviously when Holy Bull broke down, Cigar went on to win that race, and we set up this bonus with Oakland Handicap, Pimlico Special. And believe me, Billy had no intention.
Lou, we're having trouble with the phone. You're breaking up now. No good. Hold on, Lou. Yeah, I think pick up if you would with him, Joe, and let him know. In fact, you may have even have you lost him. Kind of sounds like maybe you lost him. Where he was wavering, and I was hesitating, and then you hear that interference. So we'll let Joe handle that, and we'll pause for a minute. And of course, Mosley, Lou was referencing one of the. One of the longtime managers, and yesterday that was fun with T.D. Thornton. If you missed T.D., listen to yesterday's show. That was fun. We got into Bill Veeck's tenure, short tenure, but an important tenure. Absolutely, the fact that children are allowed at the racetrack, you can thank Bill Veeck. While we wait for. Getting Lou back, let me slip in Los Al, which starts tomorrow. And you did hear a little bit of a hint about Los Al yesterday when Mike Blowen started our Suffolk conversations, because the Bertrando tomorrow, the Calbred stake, the last start of Soy Fett, and the wonderful 11-year-old has really... he's really had an amazing career, and most often we've talked to Leonard Powell about him, but 63 career starts and 15 wins. He has been good, too, at Los Al. Never off the board, but 5 wins, 2 seconds, and 10 tries at Los Al. So, Soy Fett, the big send-off. He's 4-1 tomorrow, and I'm sure everybody would love to see him go out with a win and then off to old friends. Phil D'Amato's got a little red feather. King Abner, who's 9-5 favorite, Grecian Fire in here for Jerry Hollendorfer and for the Nishes. And, of course, the Nish, the husband and wife breeder owner that was denied the opportunity to run on Sunday. They had the favorite. Jerry also has got He Will, the Cyclotron, 7-year-old, and Tool Fog, Javier Sierra. And Andrew Lerner sends out Queen Bee to you. So 6-pack for the Bertrando as they get started at Los Al. Couple of weeks, nice card. Let's bring back Lou Raffetto. And we were losing you, Lou, as you explained the move from Monmouth to join Mr. Mosley.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. Yeah, and
that's
and obviously, and I'm not sure where I left off, but going back to. What I said earlier, and I don't know if you heard me, I thought at that point in time, having left Monmouth and looking at the barbed wire around Suffolk, I didn't know if I was losing my mind making the move. I think a lot of people thought I was. But, we were able to put together a wonderful team of people. As I had mentioned, Larry Colmus, Chip Tuttle, T.D. Thornton, guys like that that have done great in the industry and beyond. And, again, being lucky enough, fortuitous enough, we put together this bonus situation back in 94 to try to bring back the mass cap at a decent level, hoping to get some good horses. It was aimed at Holy Bull, and making a long story short, along comes Cigar, wins in Florida, Gulfstream, wins the Oakland Park Handicap, and after he won the Pimlico Special, he was eligible for a $500,000 bonus. And at that point in time, in racing, that was a lot of money. That made the race like $1,000,001 because it was $650 to him. And the rest is history. I mean, he came here along the way of the streak, and as you talked about yesterday, he came back right after Dubai. I was fortunate enough to go to Dubai to see him win against All the Matter in 96. And what a lot of people don't know, even though that when he was in the middle of the win streak, he came here, and I know it was a cakewalk for him. The night before, he had an issue with his foot, and he was standing him in a tub. Billy never told me till after the race, because the last thing Bill wanted to do was scratch the horse. But anyway, he went on to win that, and as you all talked about yesterday, we were fortunate enough to have Sonny Hine come with Skip Away 2 years in a row. I mean, it was the people here in Boston respected, they love racing, but they respect the fact that the stars came here, guys like Bill Mott, guys like Gary Bailey, so on and so forth. And it's a shame that it's all gone. It really is. But it was a good run for us back in the 90s, and racing in general is obviously suffering in recent times. And the situation here at Suffolk is indicative of what's going on a national basis, quite honestly.
Lou, the potential to take the money, there's the development fund money. Give everybody a preview of what could potentially happen post Suffolk and post Rockingham. This is too big of a market, New England, to not have live racing. Not that Saratoga is so far out of reach. I mean, and it's always been a popular destination for New Englanders, during the summer. But the much publicized visit to Great Barrington about 6-8 weeks ago. Talk about what could happen down the road.
Well, there are always groups that are interested in racing, but unfortunately, like so many, most of the groups, and I'll say most of them that are interested in what comes along with racing. Does it mean a casino? Does it mean sports betting? There is at least one group I know of that's interested in possibly building a track, regardless of what happens along those lines. Again, one has to, at the same time, look at the industry. and what's going on at various racetracks in terms of the amount of horse flesh that's available. So anybody building a new racetrack has to consider what they're thinking, you know, the situation, and what one's really thinking about. As it relates to what the people here at Suffolk are looking at, and they have me looking at with them, is the possibility of going to Great Barrington, because if racing were to continue in 2020 and 21, the only place that could be up and running in a short time frame would be Great Barrington. I know it's not what a lot of people really want to hear, but quite honestly, when you talk to the horsemen, if they know they have a chance to run for real money, regardless of the fact that it would be a place like Great Barrington, they're excited about it. The thing that, if it comes to fruition, what I had only been there the one time 2 months ago or thereabouts, and it was incredible. There's 120 stalls. They're in better shape than almost every other barn area in the country. It seems hard to believe, but they're like brand new. They've been sitting there. So the stall issue is not really a problem. You have to bring some temporary stalls. The key there is what can be done in the course of 1 year, let's say. And when I went there, I saw the track was actually overgrown with weeds and grass.
Right.
And at the same time, I was told by Chip Tuttle they were thinking about widening the facility. And I said, okay, and widening the track on the outside. I said, okay, well, if you do that, you can actually make the track. It would be 3/4 mile starting at the head of the lane, so shoot, and you make it H-shaped. You push out the first turn, so it's a wider turn, wider radius coming into the turn, so it's not like a normal bull ring. But I suggested, look, let's see if we can make this a turf course, because I think if this does happen and we can make it a 6-furlong turf course and run festival-type racing, that I think it could be a really big success. But I'm not going to kid anybody, including myself, that I think that somebody can go in there, anyone can go in there next year and say, oh, we're going to run a 30-day meet. It just can't happen. And I don't know where it can happen down the line. It remains to be seen. But short-term, Great Barrington is a legitimate possibility. It'll take X million of dollars, not 25, 30 million. It might take 5 or 10 million to do what they have to do. But it's a possibility that some of the horsemen are excited about, because it helps keep them alive. And the other part that's really important is the fund, is the development fund. My greatest fear is if there's no racing next year, that development fund goes to another, it either goes to all the harness industry or it goes to some other group the politicians want to give it to. So I think to continue racing, to keep it out there, is very important, and it's a legitimate possibility.
Well, for those that never went to a fair, one of the fairs in New England, it has a life of its own and a history that is both charming and notorious. But it would be a delight, and it would be for those that have never been to Western Mass and don't know, you know, the area and, you know, Williamstown and everything out, by from Pittsfield and North Adams and all through, really delightful, the Berkshires. And I think it's a potential home run. And I know there's people that are scoffing and doubting the potential, but kind of rooting for it, to be honest, Lou.
Well, you know, again, I was very skeptical myself, believe me, never having been there. And I have to admit, after being there and looking at the area as you portray it, and looking and thinking about what can be done, okay, I sort of got excited about it. And again, it was, I look at it as another challenge. And the fact that, geez, wouldn't this be fun if we did these weekends like we're doing now, gave away real money, and we could run on a turf course. Because that ground, it had poured the day before, and the ground was really firm. So I think the grass, it would take a lot of rain, which is very important for any turf course. But I think it just would be very popular, and it's an hour and a half from from you, an hour and a half from Saratoga. And I think we'd get a lot of play in September when Saratoga was done if we wrote the right kind of races, which we always try to write a program that does make sense.
Well, Lou Raffetto, we'll see you tomorrow. Before you go, your favorite moments and a memory that whether it's a quiet one or one of the one of the banner moments, when it's all gone here, what moment will stay with you?
Well, you know, I'm going to tell you a quick story, and it's funny again. It goes back to Jim Moseley, and when we had our meetings prior to the first MassCap. We'd all sit around, and everybody had their roles, and Jim was the chairman of the board, and he was, again, a wonderful person, and he was a real sportsman. And he said to me, Lou, what do you want me to do? And I said, okay, Jim, you're in charge of the weather. And so on MassCap Day, it was a great day for all the obvious reasons. It was cloudy, lightning in the surrounding areas, rain in the surrounding area. We never got one bit of rain. And when the horses hit the track for the MassCap, and Jim and I were standing in the winner's circle, the horses were hitting the track, and all of a sudden the sun came out. And I looked over at Jim and I said, Jim, I said, God is smiling on the MassCap. And so ever since then, the subsequent years and even now, I say, Jim, you're in charge of the weather. So that's the thing that always stands out in my mind beyond the success and obviously the relationships here that I've carried on throughout my life. We had a wonderful group, and there's a lot of them still here, and that's what makes it great to come back. But that's the one thing that I always tell the story because it's 100% legit. So there you go.
I love it. And if you want to take time quickly to acknowledge the people, Lou, that have been instrumental to keeping things going and that, that behind the scenes, that names that people might not know.
Oh, we have, I mean, obviously, you know, beyond the ownership, the partnership there, I mean, you know, Chip Tuttle, John Rizzo, they're the two of the key people that have actually kept the wheels turning here. But behind the scenes, we have a fellow by the name of Ernie Sampson. He's been here for many, many years. I mean, this place couldn't operate without him. He solves every problem. I mean, we have people that have worked, in the various departments that the rank and file that I know so many of them and realistically couldn't even tell you their names anymore, but I've been gone. But, you know, and again, as I said earlier, when you go back to the T.D. Thorntons and, you know, who's been a great author and Larry Colmus, you know, Roland Hoyt. I mean, these are people that have gone on in the industry. John Morrissey in racing, Tom Creel, people have gone on to be racing secretaries in other jurisdictions. I mean, we just, you know, we couldn't have done it without them. It's always, Suffolk has always been a team effort and goes back to number one. You know, Jim Moseley was the figurehead, and that's why on this last weekend we're going to honor the one stake race we run with Jim's name.
Looking forward to it, and as T.D. Thornton said yesterday, Lou, it's going to be more of a celebration. It's not going to be a a somber benediction. It's going to be I think a lot of people are coming from all over the place to say goodbye, and including people that have never been. That's an interesting angle on it, and should be weather seems to be cooperating, so it should be a great send off to a wonderful racetrack that served the region and the industry well for almost a century.
Absolutely true. And there are some people I know that would love to have been here that it can't for sure. And one person I don't want to forget who was instrumental and he's moved on. He went to Maryland with me and he's now in New York. Glenn Kozak along the way. He's done a great job in New York. And you know Glenn. And he's been part of this team. And unfortunately, he had to choose between coming here or going to his son's graduation on Saturday. So there wasn't much of a choice. But it's going to be a celebration, as you said. And the people are... we're going to bring the owners and trainers in support of this program that are here this weekend. We're going to just have a little celebration Saturday night to relive the moments and talk about what a great sport it is.
Lou Raffetto, and dedicated to keeping this going and racing in New England. And he was called upon again, and he answered the bell one more time.
All right. Well, Steve, I appreciate the time, and I look forward to seeing you tomorrow.
You got it. Lou Raffetto, everybody. And we're going to stay here. And the next guest is another New England legend. And, I mean, there's so many of these kinds of horsemen that can be brought forth. And we've only got, what, another little less than 90 minutes to include some of them. But I vowed that we weren't going to miss the opportunity to get Don Winfrey to join us. And if you have trouble, I did let him know, Joe, that it was a 954, which might be a surprise. And Don, of course, has been doing he's been clocking at Churchill with John Nichols and with Pete Vestal and the team and John and Beth. So we're and he said it was going to be a busy day there, and he was hoping that we said we'd shoot for 10:30. If Joe, if you have trouble, you can actually switch over to Nick, who I just heard from as well. And Nick says if you call him on the landline, you'll get him. So we could flip flop and maybe get Nick Tamaro in here and get Nick's thoughts about the sequence, Belmont and Woodbine. That's an option too. All right. So if you don't get Don, and I'll let Don know that we're trying him. I mean, there's so many good horsemen all over the place that came out of New England, as Lou was suggesting, and that that includes people like Bobby DeBona and John Rigottieri, Ned Allard. And a lot of them, as the quality of racing fell below their, these horsemen, their level of frankly of accomplishment to some degree, and also the quality of the stock that they had from their owners, they had to basically relocate, and there became a pretty steady, Tampa became a winter stop. There was quite a few to the Mid-Atlantic, like we talked yesterday with Mike Arrow, Philadelphia, Delaware, Rigottieri, for instance, and that Allard, Jersey, Philly area. So, I mean, there's so many great names, and we're going to get to a few between now and noon. And I think we got Nick, so we'll relocate Don Winfrey. We got a few minutes in here with Nick Tamaro. Good morning.